Hello, this is Anaita Hangout, episode 4, our first Hangout in 2012. We are here with Rob and Scott and Steve from Anaita Police Tribes. I am Rastin Mer, here with Ash Sanyon. We are the co-founders and creators of the Anaita social networking platform and framework. And today we will be answering some questions about Anaita, and if time permits, we will be talking about social networking in general. So how's everybody today? Can you hear me? Good. If you guys could speak a bit louder, because I need to get your voice here. So I would really appreciate it. Thank you.
So far, so good.
Yeah. All right. We're going to start with answering questions today. And then after that, if time permits, let's talk about social networking in general or any topic that you're interested in. Shall we start with Rob first today? Did you have any questions?
Yeah, absolutely. So I remember from the last session that we had, I believe Ash was mentioning that you guys were going to be doing a publisher. So the publisher is traditional to LinkedIn and Facebook, where you insert a link and basically it gives you a very nice looking format of, you know, whatever media you're trying to share. Is that something that is intended to be created with the 1.6/1.7 release, or is that something that is a future?
I think you're talking about the composer, is that correct?
Yeah, sorry, I call it a publisher.
Yeah, composer we're going to have around, actually for 1.7, like you were talking about that the other day, very soon, so on top of the list to be developed. Basically, for every app, you can create the media, right from a dashboard or from the person's profile. This, however, is not the same as the one if you put a link and it would just get the web. You know, if you go to Facebook, for example, and you put a link, it just, you know, captures the web. That's a composer for a blog app, actually. So I don't know if that's something you're talking about or not, but you do have a composer that allows apps to basically hook into and provide like on-profile publishing ability for their own app.
Okay. I'm not 100% clear. Give me a little bit more detail.
For example, for the photo app, I should be able to create a photo right from the dashboard.
Yes.
From the dashboard. Or from the discussion board, I should be able to create a new topic right from the dashboard. To-do list, should be able to do that. It's basically a really fast way to publish media content for the apps.
Okay, specific to the app. So,
for example, if you, like on Facebook, if you put a link, it actually gets stored as a shared link app. Facebook is that they have a shared link app, so that's the, composing a shared link. If you have a blog app, you can just start a blog right from a composer.
Okay, so that addresses that question. And obviously, I'm not going to ask about timelines because that's something that I don't ever like asking. But is I'm assuming that 1.7 is still planned to be done within Q1 of this year. Are you just going to iterate until you feel comfortable? Like, what's your overall approach? You guys have a, you know, can you give me a little bit more detail on what you think? Is because I know that 1.7 is essentially the stable release of 1.6 and the versions of it.
That's true. Well, we wanted to release 1.6 last year, and that was what we were trying to achieve. That was just an estimate. We didn't get it right. So the work is still continuing. We are, like, since then, we've done 1,000 commits, like, close. We're getting close to the 12K commits, actually. We ended up to implementing some of the features of 1.7 and 1.6 because initially our goal was to have 1.6 was supposed to be the features of 1.5, but on the new code base. Then we wanted to add features of new features to it, and then release it as 1.7 birth, and then go and keep adding more features, anything that was related to 1.7. We realized with the new code base, we couldn't do it the 1.5 way anymore. So we had to end up building, we had to rebuild the features and also build new features towards the 1.7. So that was one reason that it took a bit longer. And also, it's a technology we're building for the first time. It's the implementation done for the first time. We can only estimate. We really don't know exactly how it's going to take. A lot of the implementations, we get to it and we decide to, okay, how are we going to do this? And we spend some time finding the best way to do it. And those make it difficult to come up with an estimate or a deadline. And also, we really like to have the freedom and time to get it right rather than keep hurrying into meeting a deadline. These deadlines are really self-imposed. They're not a promise. So we still think that we're going to have embryo this month because we are very close. We are really polishing right now. All the major features are implemented. But we really like to have Anahita used on Anahita place first before we can package a birth release and give it to you guys. So that's for the Q1 definitely. that's definitely.
If you're officially we can start developing on 1.6. I actually started publishing some tutorials for it. I don't know if you are you starting on 1.5 or 1.6?
No, we started 1.6, and a lot of the installation package. There's a lot of little things that we weren't sure if we should start digging in too deep, because mm-hmm. if it's the right version for us to play with. And there was a lot of errors that came up, so we were just wondering what's the time that we should feel comfortable. And one of the questions, in addition to what you guys have already addressed, is specifically the Shiraz template. And I know that 1.5 versus 1.6 is very, very different in terms of functionality. So can we actually build out and use the 1.6 Shiraz template that's actually available today, or do we have to wait? Will it be the same, the Shiraz template 1.6 versus 1.7, or will that change at all?
Okay, let me cover that one. 1.6 and 1.7, I don't think there's going to be a drastic difference. The template work is actually mostly done right now. The only what we have done for this release, first of all, we incorporated the Twitter Bootstrap library and also use less CSS technology. Less CSS made the CSS work really easy because when you're building an application and you want good UIs, there's going to be a lot of CSS work and they go out of control. Less CSS allows us to do CSS development in a very object-oriented fashion. So concepts such as inheritance or mix-ins or things like that can be done very nicely. So what we did, the first thing was that we removed all the CSS from the core libraries and from the apps to the Shiraz template. We said that Shiraz is the place you go and deal with the CSS. And also, we put a PHP library, Ash put his PHP library of the less CSS in. So when you write in less CSS syntax, when you refresh a page, view a page, it actually checks and compiles. And it creates a compressed and a compiled CSS, which creates the end result for you. And before, in 1.5, we are loading multiple CSS files. In the 1.6, they all actually gets collected and compiled in one single file, which results to faster rendering. And it's also a lot easier for you to manage your CSS because we actually go by domain. If you look at the CSS folder and the new Shiraz for 1.6 branch, you actually see, you literally see comments, entities, mediums, actors. So they're organized a lot nicer. So for you to rebuild your templates for 1.6 and 1.7, it's going to be a lot easier than 1.5. It's just a lot more manageable. But most of the work actually in Shiraz is done. And we also done another thing, the output, the HTML output that all the apps produce have changed. The outputs are now more simplified, more reusable. Before, in last year when we released everything, we initially wanted to make sure that all the Rocket Team templates work with Anahita, and we were still in the Joomla mindset. But then we realized that, no, this isn't working, so let's move on. So because of that, we took out a lot of redundant CSS classes. We rewrote a lot of HTML, and so there is now less HTML, which again results to lighter and faster code. And we rewrote that with the less CSS mentality. And the Bootstrap UI looks really slick. You really like it. So that's for Shiraz template.
Okay. That's exciting. Okay, I'm happy to hear that. I'm happy you guys tried Bootstrap. That's we were always worried wanting to play around with it, and the fact that you're integrating it, it's pretty cool.
Oh, it's amazing. It's the first time you actually can look up some places for tags and see how it's done and just do it rather than, you know, have something different in every place. It's a good structure.
They've done a really nice job because and everybody out there is building CMS templates. Bootstrap is really built for applications, and that's what I like about it. And also, we really wanted to have a template that doesn't have any graphics. It's going to be CSS only. And Bootstrap did a very good job.
Okay. One of the things we're going to ask, and I think we'll do it, obviously, I know you guys mentioned that you also would be willing to do some independent consulting on the side, obviously, and it would be a separate Google session, and we'll set that up separately. But
okay.
That's something we would be very interested in doing.
Sure.
Particularly because some of the stuff, it would make a lot of sense to have your input, because essentially you know the framework more than we do. I think your advice would also help us. So I think what we'll do is we'll save some of the questions we had for a more of a private consulting session.
Okay. Yeah, we'd be happy to.
Okay. In terms of specific questions, that's everything. So in terms of us being able to, our goal is to try to get very much like Anahid Topolis has set up, getting beta users on the system as early as possible to play around with it.
Mm-hmm.
Our goal is, it doesn't really matter how great the product is. It's more about getting users' feedback and determining how we can iterate based on what they're suggesting.
Mm-hmm.
So in terms of building on 1.6, whatever version we're at, when would you recommend? So by the end of the month, do you think we can feel comfortable with saying that this is what we can build on top of and we can hack?
Okay, there are two different things. One is that building on top of, you can start building right now on it.
Okay.
There are still changes, and I try to, on the 1.6 project, I do put updates. There are not as much changes, but sometimes it happens. For example, there was a minor database change, or you know, so if you're willing to reinstall, for example, your installation, because that's the easiest one. Just do a clean reinstall, and then you get everything, like when you do SVN update. So that's for development. There are some minor changes you would have to still keep up to date, but, you know, it's not much. But as having, you would be able to use 1.6 for your live site, which that's very risky, but if we are doing it, you should be able to do it too. Because we're going to have the 1.6 on Anahita Police. When it's stable, that means we tested, they have all the features, we're going to update Anahita Police with 1.6. And that is basically the time that you can actually start using it for your live site. Again, it's still beta for that time, but you know, but we're using it, so you should be able to do it, but you should be prepared for emergency sessions and things like that.
I think the best assurance is when we start using it on Anahitopolis for 1.6 Embryo, and then Embryo is the same as beta. Yeah, and you guys see it for yourself. If you feel confident and comfortable, then you can go ahead. I think that would be a good time. And yes, we are working every day, every night, to get the last things, get all the last items removed from the to do list. We are very close, and it's just that there's so many little things that need to be taken care of. Like every little, right now, a lot of the details need to be taken care of, and it's not just Anahita. A lot of the apps needed to be updated. There are 8 applications, and we also changed a lot of aspects of the applications. We changed the look of the profiles and dashboard a little bit to accommodate. It's now, the UI is now more scalable and more user-friendly, and also there's more purpose into it. I'll try to post some screen captures in a few days. So, you can see it for yourself. If you like it, you can go ahead. But right now is the best time for you to start learning the new code base. Like learning about how to work with Shiraz 1.6 and 1.7, and also just get a feel of the overall 1.6 release, because a lot has changed. If you look, there's no com social engine anymore. It's now we actually have com stories, com people, com actors, and there are some base components that other components are built upon. Just read through the code. It tells you a lot already.
Okay.
All right.
Thanks.
You're welcome. And Scott, how are you today?
Yes. doing fantastic today. I've actually got the beerlovers.com is online right now, if you can hear me, and I'm planning to start broadcasting its availability on Sunday. So essentially, we're going live with the 1.5, and it's good to hear some of the input in terms of transitioning over to 1.6 and 1.7.
Mm-hmm.
That's something I'll be obviously trying to study up on beforehand. But, it's sounding like it's not just a simple migration task. It's going to be the transfer of the data into the new table structures, right? And then each individual component is going to have a migration path as well. And then the template on top of that.
Well, for the data, yes. We do the basically for we have a concept called migrations. I mean, basically for every when we do development, we have gradual migration, like 1, 2, 3, 4. They're basically actually files, migration files. Once we're ready to release, we capture all those migration and put it as part of the update process. So technically, like on a good scenario, you should be able to this doesn't include your template, but I'm talking about just the data. So you should be able to update, and everything should get updated with the new data. There are, however, since the migration is really massive, if you have lots of data, I don't suggest using just a web install. For those cases, we can set up a time, and I can sort of have a look at your site, see how many people there are, how it is. Those ones, we can just do a simple SQL migration, basically feed the migration to your database directly. So that's for the data. For data, we do keep track of the migration. And that basically also includes the apps too. Like all the app files will get updated the same way we are doing it right now through Bazaar. Should be the same case. For your, but that doesn't include the templates. Now, like you said, there are templates that needs to be migrated. Basically, you need to update your template to the new one. What you have needs to be updated. I guess you can basically do that over time. You don't have to basically make sure that you start migrating your template now or sometime, and then when your template is ready, then when the Anita, the 1.7 is available to Bazaar, you should be able to update just smoothly. What we're hoping for, at least.
I'm looking at your template right now. See, a lot of the gantry grid and structure hasn't really changed. I see a lot of your styling is happening in the background, so that you should be fine with that. I noticed that you haven't changed the user interface inside as much, and that's a good thing. I would say your template is going to have less code. It's going to be a lot more organized when you do it for 1.6 and 1.7. And please feel free to ask us questions and work with us, because we understand this is going to be another jump. So we're going to work with you guys when you're moving forward. I'm actually going to compile a list of all the people who already launched sites to see what kind of problems you guys go through, so we can make sure that you have a smooth transition to the next release.
Scott, how much? By the way, your site looks amazing. Actually,
it's beautiful. Yeah.
Kudos, Scott. It is a nice site. I really do like it.
It's very nice. How much? Scott, the founder.
Yeah.
That's not CSS. That's just, or is it? Is that CSS? Or is it your avatar? That's like.
That's my. What I did is I created special avatars for. I think it was the medium size and the small size, and then those populate on the screen, and I rotate those using CSS.
But how does it know? Did you use a Actor plugin to add more things to it, or?
No, it's actually coded into the avatar itself. I just hard change those behind the scenes there, JPEG, and I traded a few notes with you previously about pulling up the avatar and link to an article, grabbing the author's name and putting that out there. So that's how that got integrated.
Oh, I see. That looks really nice.
It's kind of cool.
What would it say for me? Would it say something else, or?
What's that?
Oh, you put the name of the person. Yeah, okay, gotcha. Right.
Yeah.
So, do you have a lot of template overwrites, or?
No, I was working with Talia on that, and early on in the conversations, the understanding was that there was going to be some changes in the user interface in future iterations of Anahita, and so the decision was to just go very lightweight on any changes, and really all it is just addition of a few gradients and changing the padding. And
interesting. So you don't have that many template overwrites?
I'm trying to think. Very few, actually. Very few HTML overwrites.
That is very interesting, because what you've done is very nice, and I thought maybe you had some. No, the thing is, that's exactly the I was just trying to see if you had template overwrites, because one thing you've been saying to... if Andy hears this, he has lots of template overwrites. Andy, listen to this. No, basically, I mean, it's okay to have template overwrites. There's no, I mean, you know, but the whole idea is that we knew that there's going to be, we knew that that's most of our views is going to be temporary for the 1.5 because it was the first initial draft. And that was exactly the reason right now, because if you don't have that much template override, the transition would be very smooth, because you can just bring over those, like the styling, custom styling you have right to your to the style one CSS, and everything should just work fine. And especially
as long as the ID and the class is
there. Right, and yes, and also using less, you probably would be have to trim that a lot. Like you probably gonna can simplify it a lot even more.
That was one of the challenges I had, is the gradients that you see on the screen. It worked out to where I just call the gradient once and then put all the classes and IDs affected by it. And I probably did a pretty significant restructuring of how you guys have the original CSS files laid out.
Mm-hmm.
It was more just assisting me sweeping through the page and trying to pick up all the different elements and tell you to come up with and get those captured in there. So.
Oh, I see. Yeah, I can see that. No, this one you can actually, again, you can just basically using less, you can actually capture, you can even mix in, for example, your gradient to the actual classes rather than adding it to it. So for example, you can look at stories and say, from now on, every story, you can mix in the class of the gradient to it, and you actually grab the gradient and add it to the story rather than trying to use the traditional CSS, which you have to keep calling it. So, yeah, so I can see actually, yeah, you have embedded background images as well. Is that correct?
Correct. Behind Oh,
so did you actually copy paste those, or did you use some kind of a tool for that?
Tally. I've worked with Tally on those, and those are being served off of an Amazon server to try and get a faster delivery.
Okay, that's it. The Less CSS compiler, I don't know about the PHP one, but it actually also embeds images as well. So if you give it a URL image, it actually grabs it.
Fantastic.
And puts it there for you, so you don't have to do that. But I know it's some. Embedding image is supposed to be faster on for styling.
Okay.
That's really interesting.
Scott? What's the marketplace? What's your intention with the beer marketplace?
Well, the entire concept on this is to just build out a platform for any level of interest related to beer. The marketplace, what I'm working on right now is essentially two different components to it. One is person-to-person sales. For example, if you type in beer in eBay, there's a couple hundred thousand items that are trading hands on there. And then additionally, what I'm looking to do is hosted merchandising sales for brewers and give them a community presence, a place to put out their messages, what new beers are available or what beers are being served at a particular establishment, and then additionally get brand promotion, brand discovery to the community there. So if you have a special interest in anything, maybe do some beer-related art, we can put that in the marketplace as well. So kind of let the community drive the direction that it ends up taking.
Very cool. I like the concept.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
It's about beer, and the site looks so darn good.
So basically, to summarize your question, for the data migration, yes, we will have all those information or basically migration script. Preferably, I try to make it as easy as you can just do it with a simple click in Bazaar. The only problem with that is that it's the amount of data that you have. For example, if you have hundreds of thousands of record, probably the web upload would probably time out. So. But maybe for you it wouldn't be that much, or because right now, for the Anitopoly, by the time we have it, then you should be fine. I'm gonna test it with the Anitopoly data, see if it actually times out or not, because we have quite a number of records right now.
it's, you know, I understand there's going to be a lot of planning on my part, probably, in terms of, you know, making sure that everything's a smooth transition. There's not a lot of downtime on the site when the transition occurs, so.
Oh, no, you have, yeah, you definitely have to do it on your developer one, and then you can, like, once you launch, I guess this Sunday, you can basically sort of, it's an ongoing process. it's never stops, like, you just try to make it as easy as possible. I'm probably going to start a one tutorial for less development. It's not a big tutorial because it's not that difficult, but I'll probably want to put one, sort of explain how the less works and how the compiler compiles, and basically, because you shouldn't have to rely on any other tool to compile. The PHP compile, like your browse, your template, the Shiraz template should actually compile your less for you.
Okay.
So you don't have, you just write it in less, then you have, on the other side, you have, just have CSS. I'm just going to write a tutorial for that one, I guess, and then you should be able to start doing that.
Yeah, right now, when you edit a less file in Shiraz, and then you refresh your site in a browser, it checks to see if there has been any change in the less files, and it recreates a new CSS file for you. And everything gets compiled and added to the style1.css or style2, depending on what style you're using. So the site loads only one CSS file and rather than multiple one, and it's compressed. So it loads a lot faster, renders a lot faster. Except there are still some other CSS files. I think one is the Gantry core and one is Joomla. Hopefully, as we later build our own template framework, it's going to be even leaner. So that's going to be after, like, probably for 1.8. But for the time being, we made it work nicely with Gantry.
I actually came to like the Gantry framework quite a bit, as I understood it. It was a challenge to figure out coming to it without much background in it. But
yeah,
there's a lot of flexibility and a lot of power that it really brings to the table.
It's a brilliant concept because it provides a grid, and when you build a layout, you need to have a grid, and you can manage the grid. You can just assign your elements to different positions. It's well organized as a package. It's the layer that takes care of your look and feel, except that it's built for CMS, and we are not using a lot of the features of it, but we still carry around the code. We use maybe 20% of the Gantry for Anahita. We'd really like to have a template framework that does that 20% and more specifically for an application environment or social networking. It's a great concept, Gantry, so we're going to use a lot of good ideas in Gantry for that.
I don't know if you mind taking the conversation in this direction, but being that I'm looking to launch on Sunday...
Okay.
I'm looking more with the mindset of community management now and building a community. And when I think of the Beer Lovers project, I don't want it to be about one particular person or one particular aspect of beer and have it be all-inclusive. And so if I look at how you guys manage Anytopolis, it's essentially a centric community around groups that you guys create and manage and kind of lead the conversations across all the different platforms. And so there's probably a different mindset when you're trying to build a far-reaching community. And I don't know if you have some thoughts or some advice you can share with that concept in mind.
I think at the beginning, what you do is that you decide what kind of people you want to have. And what kind of people you don't want to have. The second one is very important. What kind of people you don't want to have. Because then you can filter those out from the beginning and then let anybody else in. Like for Anahitapolis, the kind of people we didn't want to have were people who roam around for the tire kickers and people who just want to try and play. They don't have a actual mission. They don't have a purpose or project. And these people, like there are a lot of them hanging around in a lot of open source communities, unfortunately, and that they don't actually do things. They just hang out, and they are also the source of a lot of trouble, rather than people who are actually focused, they're interested, they're sharing content and contributing and all of that, which is why we set up a forum for the free accounts, and we said that, tell us in 30 words, what are you trying to do? That alone made a huge difference. Like, there are people who are entering rude words or jokes or things like that. You can tell these people are not serious, and you don't want that. But if someone tells in a very simple language, that I'm building a social network for students or for a community, or things simple as I want a social network just to stay in touch with my friends and family members, like even that small scale. Or some people go really world domination, and they don't have to really give away any business secrets or whatever they're uncomfortable with. Just tell me in one sentence, two sentences, what are you trying to do? That's enough. That will do. I think it's important that you know what kind of people you don't want and plan on how to filter those out. And also, the first people in your community are going to seed the culture. They're the founders of your community. So the first few hundred people, the first thousand people are very important because they're going to set the culture. And they attract more like-minded people. And they repel the kind of people you don't want. So you got to get that first people right. So think to yourself, what kind of people do you want to have? And also, you're going to see what kind of people you're attracting. You have to optimize your message to attract the kind of people that you want, or they may surprise you. You may get some kind of people that you actually like to have. That is really an art form. For the first 100 people or for 50 people, you don't even have to open to public right away. Handpick people and add them in. And those are the initial people, people who are really dedicated to your cause. I think it's fine for a social network to not go 100% open and let everyone in. For the first 100 people at least, you can add them one by one yourself. And you can pick and choose and tell people this is a site you've launched and this is what it's going to be about. And if you see someone is interested and passionate and they want to be part of it, then you add them in one by one. And then once you have enough user base, so like you have 100, 200, then you can slowly, gradually open up to people.
Okay.
Yeah. But if you open up from day one and you're empty and not many are on the site, it's not going to have a very good effect. And you may attract a lot of wrong people too. Just like when you have a party at home, you don't just open up to the doors to everyone. You first start with close friends, and then you start with clusters of people who know each other. And then you introduce them together. And then as you have enough people, and then you can gradually introduce people that you haven't met yet, but they're potential to be good friends or good business networkers, and depending on what venue you're putting together.
Okay.
Did I answer your question?
Yeah, I appreciate that.
Yeah.
No, you did. And you know, one thing, if I look at some other sites out there, one of the ones that comes to mind is meetup.com.
Mm-hmm.
It's essentially a platform for groups to form their own interaction and host their own discussions and things like that. And so if I think about building a community in their mindset, you know, they're very much subject agnostic. But they do have this community aspect and kind of building that with it.
Yep.
And it's a little bit different than what I've been watching you guys do on Anahitopoulos. And great information.
Let me tell you something. Meetup.com, actually, I did receive an email from the founder on 9/11, on September the 11th. And when Meetup.com started, they did have a mission. It happened, I believe, according to him, after 9/11 attack. And he wanted to launch a site to bring people together. And that's how it started. But then, over time, it became a more general purpose, a place to organize meetups. And if you look at the origin of a lot of social networks, they had one specific purpose at the beginning. Twitter was used as an intranet for a team of
communication.
It was used as a communication tool for a team of people to stay in touch with each other's updates. And then they thought that what will happen if we let everyone else use this as well? And that's how Twitter was born. Facebook was first used by a group of students on the campus. Yeah, and then they were exchanging information and pictures and flirting or exchanging exam questions and a lot of things that was deemed illegal, even probably by Harvard or any university's regulations. And then they gradually expanded to other campuses. In fact, Mark Zuckerberg was at the beginning was so keen to build a social network for school campuses. I don't think he ever imagined at the beginning this is going to be a worldwide social network. But then gradually they opened up to the rest of the world. And now you see anyone, any all the brands, and everyone is no longer for the school. So for your social network, you start with the most sticky and most possible cause and community first. And then you gradually grow to become more like wherever it goes. Because as you go, you observe your community as it's growing and you gradually add other concepts to it until it grows. Flickr started initially, I believe there were game developers that were sharing screen captures, and then the founder decided that, hey, I can turn this into a photo sharing site. And then Yahoo bought them, and then, I mean, they grew, become a worldwide photo sharing site. So,
start focused.
Yeah.
It's very important because that basically determines the culture of your community over time.
Yes.
I mean, that's basically what we've learned. In the beginning, it's a little bit hard because, you have the intuition is that let everybody in, let everybody in, because you want to populate the site. But that actually, over time, might not work in your favor. But having a focus in the beginning goes a long way. And it's very difficult, like community management. I mean, Russ is doing the most of it. I do. But every day he has to send reply back emails, people trying to basically get free accounts. And like out of every, 10 emails we get on a daily basis.
We get like around 10 emails inquiries a day for the free accounts and everything, but I'm very picky still to let whoever in, and because we are still growing a community, and I do all kinds of research actually. For example, if someone is putting in jokes or they put in, or rambling or putting nonsense in, I say they don't take us serious. Why should I take them serious? Or people who are too protective about giving information, and we are not really asking for much. We don't use this information on any, like we even cancel our MailChimp account because I thought Anahitopoulos is doing a much better job than newsletters. and I said, well, we are sharing 4,000 hours of our work with you. Can you tell me like 30 words about your project? So, but there are people who are so passionate, so ready, so excited to be in, and now you look at like it's such a joy every day for us to interact with people, because when you see the community with the right people, they create the right gravity to attract other people, so we are willing to spend time getting to know all the initial people who are getting in. And we get a very diverse groups of people. We get people from certain faith groups or religious groups. We get people from complete opposite of that. And I actually go in sometimes and spend time reading their websites and to make sure there is no hate is happening, there is no discrimination is promoted under and underside and all of that. I used to work in the Joomla, and I was a part of the Joomla team. And later, when I was the Green Movement was happening in Iran, I realized that the government of Iran was using Joomla to expose the protesters, and I felt terrible. And I said, "Here's my open source project that I contributed, and some dictator government is using it." but that's just how open source is. It's out there. Anyone can use it. But when you're building a community, you do want to have, especially for the first people, you do want to screen out. And then the community itself becomes a tool for you to keep the wrong people away and to attract the right people.
Okay.
I'm a strong believer in that. There's a book called Art of Community. It's written by Juno Bacon and also Leo Laporte. They've done a very good job. It's really about a technology community, but a lot of the rules in it applies. They try to write it as generic as possible, and there are so many useful chapters in it on instructions and guidelines about how to do podcasts, how to write blog posts, how to...
I've read The Art of Community. It's fantastic.
Yeah. Or how to, I don't know, contact a reporter or get a press release, or how to group like-minded people and how to inspire people. It's got everything. It's really the most comprehensive book that I've seen until today.
Rastin?
Yes?
I started reading a book called The Smart Swarm.
Mm-hmm.
It talks about, believe it or not, how they relate nature to the building of communities. And the psychology of insects and so on. And a lot of it's quite practical. So, and based on the way you think, I think you'd actually quite enjoy it.
It's
so,
awesome. I like the name.
Yeah. Oh, Smart Swarm. Basically, understanding flocks and schools and colonies and how that relates to practical applications. So,
I actually wanted to introduce three books last time, but the last hangout didn't happen because of the New Year.
Robert, this and concept. Me and Russ, like, he brought this up so many times, this ant thing.
Studying the...
like an ant. So, it's interesting that we didn't actually have any class names called ant in Nanaito. He brought this up, like, a million times, that, you know, this is social networks are like ants.
There's some. I'm going to post them today because I know Ravi from Anaitopolis. He was keep reminding me to post the name of the books. One of them is called Emergence, and the other one is Nexus, and also Sync. And thank you for the new name. Later when I posted these, please add your book because I'm looking for new reading material. Because these books are a little dated. Like Emergence came out when Web 2.0 became so the big hit on the internet. But it is essentially about swarm intelligence, about hive intelligence, and how ants, for example, or bees, like one ant is not particularly smart, but when you look at the ant colony, they can solve a really complex mathematical problems, such as the traveling salesman problem. Look on Wikipedia for it. I'm not going to explain here right now. And it shows that we have, a colony of ants or even a colony of brain cells and how do they interact and intelligence comes out of that. Or Sync talks about, it's actually from Stephen Strogatz, and he's a physicist and a mathematician. He's talking about how order comes out of chaos, which goes against our belief system. We are all raised to believe that chaos is chaos and, you know, like you have to have order and centralized governance. And it shows that in nature, order actually comes out of chaos amazing ways. And lots of examples. Sync is a little more scientific because probably a little heavier read, but it's a fascinating read. Nexus and Emergence. Emergence is from Stephen Johnson, and Nexus is from Mark Buchanan, I believe, if I pronounce the names correctly. They are easier reads, but they're fascinating. And also, what was the name of the book again, Rob?
It's called The Smart Swarm.
Smart Swarm.
The author is Peter Miller.
Okay, I'm gonna get that.
There's the picture again.
Yes, I'm a big...
And it completely relates to the stuff you talk about, so that's why I thought for sure you have at least a chance to read it. It is all about everything to do with nature and the practical applications that applies to modern-day technology.
I'm a big fan of swarm computing or studying swarm intelligence. It's my topic of interest. Thank you very much. Any other topic? We have about 10 more minutes. Anything else you guys want to talk about?
The only thing I wanted to get your guys' opinion on is how Google is integrating Google Plus into their social search. What's your take on that? I personally feel it's very invasive. What's your again? Obviously, you can talk hours on this, but what's your overall impression on their approach?
I think it's the right way to do it, actually, because I think, like, let's say 10 years ago, 12 years ago, and Google, 10 years ago, Google came with this concept of giving ranks to web pages based on the incoming links and outgoing links. So if you had a web page and a lot of incoming links are coming and the origins of those links are from pages that have high authority and good content, therefore your page probably has good content and high ranking. And they built a algorithm around that, and that's how Google was born. There's a problem with that concept. Back then, people created links manually in their Dreamweaver, and there was actually some thoughts and intentions behind it. Today, you can write a PHP script that can create 2,000 links, outgoing, incoming, really quickly. People are crowdsourcing content development. They do all kinds of things to fool the system. And I think because now all the links are created are automated, they're created automatically. Social ranking, being able to actually plus one a link or a page, page brings back that concept that, okay, now individual people actually say that I recommend this link, this is a good link. And I think that's probably more immune to future hacks or black hat ways to manipulate the crowds, unless marketeers find a way to manipulate crowds of people to plus one a page. But that's still going to be far more difficult than finding programming ways.
Let me ask you this. I just find it very interesting to know. What aspect do you find it? Did you say intrusive or invasive?
Invasive. Well, yeah. I'll give you a practical example. So, one of the things is when you use circles. So, circles defines your social graph in G+.
Right.
And I use it passively. So, I'll add people that I don't necessarily really know into a circle that I didn't really define very well. And when those people become a part of my social context or my search, it becomes irrelevant. So, for instance, if someone that I put into don't really care about circle starts becoming a person that contributes content regularly and certain search strings show up as a result of that individual being in my circle, becomes quite becomes useless. So one of my challenges is it means that, you know, Google is taking my identity and basically saying it's an ubiquitous identity. And the people that are within my circle should thus justify who I am as an individual. So I have a hard time seeing that the outputs within my social group.
Okay, I think they're two different concepts. So you're saying Google filter things based on your social graph rather than based on...
Well, it's more about the personalized search, right? The what they just created and introduced, which I have a hard time understanding.
Yeah. So what they've done is that they basically bind the search results to your social graph. Yeah, I see what you mean, because like when you go on, because before Google, there was no social network for Google, so the Google search was an independent app. Now they're tying it to G+. So you're not against using plus ones in general to bring the highest result. You're just against plus one that comes from your social graph.
Yes, because I've never taken the diligence to go through social graph, as most people don't, right?
Yeah. Well, one thing is that the... It's not your fault. The circles of Google Plus is not a really, it's not a pragmatic. It's not really useful. Like we talk about all the time that within a social network, you don't, things have to happen passively. We call it frictionless. You shouldn't have to think how to organize it. I mean, I think Rustin started with the G Plus organizing in the beginning. We had, how many circles did you have, Rustin?
Well, right now I have about 500 people added me to their circles, and I have about 500 people in my circles. And I did initially organize like people, like, okay, these are tech celebrities, these are politicians, these are. But when I post things, I always post it publicly.
Yeah, so I think that organizing go against that whole concept of social networking because. It's just a lot of work.
Yeah. And if I want to privatize it, and like if I want to message few people, yes, it's like a lot of the concept is useful. For example, if I want only Ash and Rob and Steve and, you know, Scott and everyone like see a picture or see a video, or then I can privatize. That's nice. But I would say 99% of time I post everything publicly because I'm there to share. So that's not really a proper user. And I know people who say, okay, I post content only from my circle of artists or circle of that. But I have programming friends who are also artistic. or I have people who are interested in like a little bit of everything. But I think what Google is doing is, say, when you circle someone, you have something in common with them at some level. Maybe 10%, 20%. There's something about them that interested you. And therefore, their opinion matters. When they plus one something, it's very likely that you're going to like that content too. So,
right. So what I was trying to get at is that, yeah, there are two aspects of a plus one. It's good to get the search result based on the highest plus one. If hundreds of people like some link, sort of the way that Delicious used to work, or Reddit, because basically it's like a book.
Or dig.com. Yeah.
Or dig.com. Basically... Yeah. They're not the people who are necessarily in your social graph that dig something. It's really the ranking. But what you have against is that, well, if I'm following somebody, is there any way that I don't necessarily, if they like something so much, can you not show up in my search result? Because I want to use my search independently. Because the Google search, I understand that because I use the Google search extensively for a lot of things, like code snippets and things like that. It's just a matter of somebody who's so irrelevant, but in my Google Plus comes up in my Google Plus and it screws up all my search results. So in that case, the only thing you can do is just the whole idea is that you have nothing, you don't have that much comment with the person you're following, so you probably should unfollow that person. That's what I can tell you. And that's basically what Google wants you to do, because they want to make their search part of their G+. The Google search is no longer an independent platform anymore. It's part of their... It's like going to Facebook and trying to search for something. You wouldn't be surprised if Facebook uses the same concept, because you're used to that concept. Now it's time for people to get used to that concept for Google Plus. I'm not saying it's bad or good. I know there's downside of it, but that's what they want to do, because that sort of makes sure that the business survives.
I think what they're doing is relevant, though, Ash, aren't they? Because look at the dig.com concept. They use the entire crowd. And the problem is, when you look at the entire crowd, it whatever content that is mainstream goes up. But if I'm, let's say...
That's different.
Yeah. That works for mainstream things. That works if you are looking at the most popular pop music or most pop... But let's say I consider myself a non-mainstream person. I listen to a lot of swing and jazz, and I wear different hats, and like I have weird friends. So, and I follow those people, and when those people plus one things, anytime I search the Google, I get those kind of contents coming to me more often. So that means I can find my non-mainstream content that I want coming to me faster. Because I have some non-mainstream friends in my or subculture friends, let's say, in my social graph. And something like dig.com would never be able to do that, because dig.com only brings me what mainstream wants. So the Google Plus approach actually focuses on what your niche or your interests are, and your social graph are more or less like yourself. People come and say that, oh, Facebook is a place for such and such. And say, no, your social graph is for such and such. Like, some people say Facebook is for partying, like 6 years ago, for partying teenagers posting pictures. And I said, no, you're following a lot of partying teenagers, therefore that is all you see. Follow some business websites or some businessmen or some technologists, and then you're going to get more business and technology updates coming to you. Social networks are... Like your perspective of social networks is what your social graph is not. It doesn't represent the entire social network necessarily. So
no, that's true.
Yeah,
that's true.
That's what Google is incorporating in the search results, is that your social graph thinks like you. Therefore, this is what they recommend. And I think that's where
they're
going.
That is true, but there's an issue, is that not like when I look at my social graph, for example, they're not necessarily people who. There might be acquaintances that I don't have necessarily, like, for example, if I look at it, like, if let's say my mom was on Google Plus, I would have followed her.
Yeah.
You know, because I have a responsibility.
That's true.
But by no means she shared the same idea. So if you strictly keep your social graph toward interest, yes, I agree. But that doesn't necessarily what happens on the social networks. That's what I meant, but... telling Rob that, yes, if you really absolutely have nothing with the person you're following, then the only way to do this is to unfollow that person to make your search results more relevant.
And one of the things I noticed is basically social networks are all about reciprocity. So if someone follows you, typically follow them back, circle them back. And what happens with this logic, it makes it almost impossible to say, you know what, I'm not going to follow you back, because I have to actually understand who you are. So... I agree there's value in that, and what happens is people who are influencers become much more, there's much more social capital with people that are influencers, because now they're not only swaying decisions, but they're also swaying information, which is something I have a hard time with, because if you're a knowledgeable resource, you know, it doesn't matter if you're knowledgeable, it means that you have more people that are following you. It's not based on sheer knowledge or understanding of a concept, it's based on how many people you're actually, you know, influencing. That's my initial issue.
And
it does happen, and the thing, and the problem with those is not circles. We talk about, like, Google tried to do that by having circles so you can organize your graph. We think that can be done by having many social networks that you can actually join social network for the based on a different context, right? And have every of your contacts come to one place, which is, let's say, like Facebook or Google. The only problem is that Google has a power of this. They also have their search, so they're sort of in their social network, which happens based on, you know, you follow people based on basically, you know, you follow me and I follow you back, but that affects your other aspect of the Google for you as well. So that becomes tricky for people like who are using Google, let's say Google search.
I think ideally a service could come that just like Sumify or their other content curation sites, but that I can tie in my Facebook and Twitter and Google Plus and Instagram, all these social networks that I'm on, could tie in those accounts, and then the search engine would bring me the content off the web based on the curation that is happening on different social networks.
Only Google wouldn't do that because it's a monopoly that they have.
Yeah, yeah, and that's the monopoly part that comes in because Google says, hey, I have the search.
Control the information on the web. Now they're tying it to your... So they're two different things because we use Google Plus as a social network and there's a Google search which is done differently. Except Google Plus monopoly here in this case is, listen, I'm going to tie everything I know about you on the Google Plus to your search results. And traditionally, the search results... So no other social networks can influence... Like, listen, your Twitter cannot influence your social... Your results on Google on a Google search, which is the monopoly of Google, basically. That's... You know,
that's true, right?
Because they own the data.
if your bread and butter comes from the SEO of your site, and you know your life depends on all the plus ones and G plus as well, that's true.
So I think it has to be independent service that other social networks can hook into, and that's maybe would be dangerous for Google because Bing, for example, they're not for whatever reason they're doing using the Facebook. If they open up their platform to other social networks that brings more relevant results from everywhere, basically from all the other social networks, then influence the result based on that. You probably more likely to get a better result than coming from one social network. So it's their game. You have to see what happens.
Well, Google did try to get live content from Twitter or Facebook. They just didn't want to share. That is the other problem as well. I mean, Google indexes whatever it can from Twitter and Facebook pages, whatever is public. But they don't have access to that really nice raw data of number of likes on a link or number of comments on a link or how many times the link has been viewed or shared or things like that. Cool.
So, in short, you have to, your only chance is either do a private search or unfollow the people on your social graph that don't represent you, because I can see where you're coming from, because I do use the Google search extensively for things that are not necessarily happens on my Google Plus, because they're so random. And it's just a matter of having one person in the crowd that just leads me to the wrong direction.
We're going to incorporate that in Anahita, actually, not Google Plus, but the search that we have, it's going to be sorted based on the number of likes, number of comments, or...
that's different, because we're still
probably,
in our community, that's actually good, we will do that actually for 1.6, when we're doing the results for topics and things like that, we just a matter of ordering it based on the likes, and because we already have all those information now.
All right. I think we reached our 1 hour for today's session. And how did you guys find it? Was it good?
Yeah, enjoyable as always.
Enjoyable as always. Okay. I think the next one happens in 2 weeks from now. So if anyone wants to be, and I created the page so you can actually edit and add your own name on the Hangout group. But okay, so today we had another Hangout session, and... I'm going to wish you a wonderful, productive, and prosperous day, and Happy New Year. And let's do some more world liberation, whether it's with beer or anything else, and launch awesome projects, social networking projects this year. It was a pleasure having you guys. Thank you very much.
Thanks. Thank you.
It's a pleasure talking to you guys.